Well, so far, by the use of concept, we've been developing an understanding of emptiness. However, for the arising of insight into how things really are, into ultimate reality, one must go beyond concept. From here on, the sutra is concerned with an explanation of how a bodhisattva, an enlightenment being, goes beyond all concepts towards enlightenment. So we're starting this morning with, therefore, a Shariputra, it is because of his indifference to any kind of personal attainment that a bodhisattva, through having relied on the perfection of wisdom, dwells without thought coverings. In the absence of thought coverings, he has not been made to tremble. He has overcome what can upset, and in the end he attains to nirvana. I thought before I started talking about it that I'd read you out what Konzer has to say about through having relied on the perfection of wisdom. It's quite interesting. He says, this phrase restates the practical meaning of the attitude by which emptiness was gained. What one had to do was not to rely on anything worldly or otherwise, to let it all go, to give the resulting emptiness a free run, unobstructed by anything whatsoever, or by the fight against it, to stop relying on anything, to seek nowhere any refuge or support. That is to be supported by the perfection of wisdom. The perfection of wisdom can, of course, be equated with emptiness. So at this stage, the bodhisattva relies on nothing but emptiness. He is able to bear the absolute aloneness of his solitary spirit, our separate self as a spurious reality, which can maintain itself only by finding supports or props on which to lean or rely. This tendency is rooted in the very fibers of our being. The kind of mental life which springs from ignorance seeks forever to build a fictitious security on which it is, in fact, quite unstable and untrustworthy. To go for refuge to the three treasures is the central act of the Buddhist religion. It is its central insight that neither heaven or earth are my shelter, that a safe shelter is to be found nowhere at all. He isn't, of course, saying that we can't rely conventionally on support from friends or others. It's in a spiritual sense that there is nothing that we can really find as a support. Everything's marked with emptiness, so what do you think of it? Any comments on it? Sound a bit bleak?
It's quite hard. The last sentence is quite hard, I think.
It's very reminiscent of many out of fear flee for refuge to trees, shrines and groves. These in reality are not a safe refuge, you know, the Dhammapada verse.
Yes. Yeah.
But it's just that it's the safe shelter metaphor, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
When I read stuff like that, I just relax. That's the thing, I just relax. I don't find it bleak at all, personally.
No. On the face of it, it can sound that, and your solitary spirit just...
I just relax, I just think...
Yeah. I mean, I find it quite... I liked it as soon as I read it.
I find it quite frightening if I really think about it.
Do you? Yeah.
Because... Well, you know, we all do take refuge in things, and actually, you're right, in convention, I don't agree with you that in conventional reality we can rely on anything, because we do rely on friends, we do rely on houses, cars, the fact that the car will work when you put a key in the ignition, and all of these other things, and although they mostly do, they're not absolutely reliable.
Oh, no,
there's nothing that's 100% reliable.
Yeah.
But we fool ourselves that they are.
That they are a support.
And I think that's quite, you know, it's like stepping out on a tightrope.
Is that not the point? The point is there's no ultimate refuge in them. He's not saying that you can't rely upon them. He's going to say the ultimate act is to go for refuge to the three jewels. Obviously, that includes the Sangha, doesn't it? And all the things like spiritual community and friendship and all the rest of it. So it's like you're relying on them. And you're relying on all the various things that help you develop as a human being.
Well, that's actually what the Heart Sutra says. It says you can't rely on anything at all.
Ultimately, that's true. But I mean, we're not quite at that point. You know, ultimately, we have to kind of move to that.
May take refuge in the three jewels. Yeah. But even ultimately, those aren't reliable.
That's true.
Well, that's what the Heart Sutra said.
That's what the Heart Sutra says.
We've already said that.
Yeah.
That you can't rely even on
the three jewels.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I'm not relying on my car.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean you take the three jewels and just chuck them away. that's your means. Yeah, it's a springboard, you could say, couldn't it?
Yes. But he's talking about the Bodhisattva.
Right.
Who has got to a certain stage.
Yeah.
In his practice.
But he doesn't have to rely on him.
Who doesn't have the need to rely on him. Anyway, I thought it was interesting enough to handwrite.
Yeah, most things are obviously transitory, so you can't depend on them for long.
Well, that's the point, yes. Everything is empty, it's transitory. There's nothing fixed at all that is a real support. Well, of course, the perfection of wisdom is directly pointing to emptiness. So the Bodhisattva relies only on emptiness. He has realized there is no separate, independent self, and that all phenomena are insubstantial. Thus, a Bodhisattva is indifferent to the concept of a self or person. And through having relied on the perfection of wisdom, he dwells without thought coverings. He dwells without thought coverings. This is, of course, very important, this idea of dwelling without thought coverings. And what you might call our normal mode of being, we more or less instantaneously identify and label every object of perception. As soon as we have a perception, consciously or subconsciously, we identify it and we put a designation on it, we put a label on it. As soon as we do that, we impute a self. We've given it permanence as soon as we label it. And when we do that, we separate it from the observer, and we separate it from other objects of perception. So we immediately create a duality between ourselves and the object, and between other objects. We give them that permanence, and we have a reaction to it. As again, either consciously or self-consciously, we're either attracted, we like it and want to repeat the experience if it's a good experience, or we reject it, it's painful, or it's somewhere in that range. And of course, that is the cause of suffering. We want to cling to the pleasant and reject the unpleasant or the painful. To dwell without thought coverings, if we are in a state of not imputing a self. If we have a perception, but we see it just with awareness, we don't label it. We don't attach to it or reject it. We don't try to repeat it or substitute the pleasant for the unpleasant. So we are not in that state of grasping and suffering. So, to dwell without thought coverings, if we have a mind which is still, and we're observing every perception without imputing a self on it. If there's no thought coverings, then there's no imputations onto the object of perception. If the mind is completely still. So, to dwell without thought coverings is to see things as they are, without the imputation, without the projection of a self onto them. It's when the Buddha said, and the seeing onto the seen, and the hearing onto the heard. This is the same thing that this is the same. So to dwell without thought coverings is to observe or to see things as they really are without imputing a self onto it. So, dwell without thought coverings is to have a mind that is still and calm and without discursive thought.
So it has to be a mind that's free from craving, aversion and delusion, really, wouldn't it? Because that's what causes us to impute those things, doesn't it? You know, it's the gradual breaking down of just, you know, poisons, basically. It causes us to put those things on.
Well, I think the experience of dwelling without thought coverings is something that we can experience in meditation, in a deeper meditation.
As long as the hindrances aren't present, I think we probably have experience of this, but don't necessarily think, recognize it as such.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or if you're in a very positive mental state, you're not meditating, but you're in a very positive mental state, and the hindrances aren't present. I think there's we probably can operate in this way, but aren't necessarily relating to this.
Yeah, to be quite honest, I think it's something that most of us have experienced, probably without recognizing it. It might be just a momentary thing that we get such an experience. When I've spoken of this before, I've used Dhanakosha as an example, actually, of in the morning, a lovely fresh morning, you go out and you look up the loch there, and what you see, the mountain, there's a snow cap on it, there's a still loch with reflections in the loch. But when you look up there, that first moment of that perception, your mind is completely still. There's no thought in it at all. It's like a sort of moment of awe, if you like. You're looking at that. And then after that instant or two, you think, how wonderful. Look at the mountain, look at the reflections, and you stick labels in everything. And you're immediately imputing the self. You've got discursive thought going. For different people, I'm sure it can happen in different ways, with artists that might get it observing a magnificent painting for them. You see it in that, for that moment or two, as it is. They're not projecting their self or any kind of self onto it.
See, to me, that's almost like the crux of the matter. To me, I find, actually, it's not me imputing something on external thing. The actual crux is when I impute me on me. But that is the start of the discursive thought, that as soon as I become me, I think that is wonderful. I want to touch that, I want to smell that, and it's so actually for me the initial point is sticking me on me.
But it's you that is imputing anyway.
Yeah, and that for me is like the first point of it all, is when I impute myself.
Well, yes, well you're imputing a self onto yourself, but also onto the object that you're perceiving.
Before I even thought about Buddhism, I can recall times that I would call meditation, and maybe moments like that, way before I get involved in this stuff at all, just kind of spontaneously arose. You didn't have anything to call it, you know, you couldn't call it a meditation, you couldn't call it a, you know, it was just mostly in the wilderness, mostly outdoors in certain places, you know. But it's nice to think that even without the knowledge that you've got now, with Buddhism and meditation and these things, you know, it spontaneously arises in everybody, really, you know? that's nice to think that as well, and just take it out of context of the, yeah, what we know. I suppose it is a natural ability can identify it in everybody, you know, it's there.
Yes, these, well, I see these as being as moments of just naked awareness. There's nothing but awareness in those moments of, you know, seeing without thought at all.
I find it easy with music, and I mean, not necessarily a revelation all the time, but I've known T.S. Eliot in one of his four quartets to say, you are the music while the music lasts. And that was his, he wrote that in response to his own response to a late Peter Uncle Ted's slow movement, the timelessness of it.
But, of course, the perfection of wisdom is synonymous with emptiness. Mm. That it's synonymous with the middle way of Tratichi Samutpada. The Bodhisattva is seeing things in their real way, you know, as just a flow of phenomena. He's not seeing any self at all in anything. So he's not holding on to anything. He sees there's nothing to rely on, you know, and that there's no attainment or non-attainment. But that's going back right to what we were talking about at the very beginning. If we see that there's no abiding, you know, and we think of this as aggregate simultaneity, that you cannot define any instant of becoming. You can never say anything is or is not. So there's no attainment and there's no non-attainment. He's seeing everything in that way as it is, that it's got no self and that it's indefinable as something. There's nothing graspable or that you can attach to. There's no support. There's nothing you can take as a support. Because nothing is or is not. It's neither existent or non-existent. And this is in that very first thing, well, on the second day when we looked at the true nature of an instant of becoming. When we looked at the idea of simultaneity, and you couldn't say that in that instant it was the phenomenon that was arising or the phenomenon that was ceasing. It was something instant, you know, simultaneously. So there is never a is or a is not in anything. There's not existence or non-existence. There's only the middle way. That's all there is. Pratitya Samutpada, the middle way of the flow of phenomena. There is nothing that you could hold on to, the Bodhisattva. There's no thing with a self.
The only difficulty I have with this is its formulations. It's quite negative. It says there is no support, but there actually is also no non-support.
Yeah, well, if you like to put it that way, yeah. There neither is or is not.
There neither is nor isn't. So, I mean, I just thought, that, you know, I look at this and I think, well, that's quite frightening in some ways. But it's quite frightening if you say there's no support, but there's also no non-support.
That's perfectly true, yeah. Yeah.
And therefore,
you find that a bit more reassuring then.
That's more reassuring. I mean, you could almost paraphrase this and invert this, everything, and it would still be correct.
Well, yes, it comes down to that you can say nothing is or is not. Support doesn't exist or it does not exist. There's no existence or non-existence, there's only the flow of phenomena. So there is no support, but there's no support.
I mean, to use my tightrope analogy, it feels like you're about to walk out on a tightrope. Someone's been helping you all along the way. But when you get out there, it's not that they're not there, but they're not there.
That's right. There's nothing to walk on.
There's nothing. Well, there's still a tightrope, but those people who are helping you can't help you anymore. But they're still there.
Can I just, this thought coverings issue, because one of the things that I've been trying to get a grip on with this thought coverings thing is clearly the Buddha functions perfectly well, you know, is able to go about his business. Now, Is that because if you have a full awareness of the provisionality of relative existence, in a sense, you're still... So there must still be thought involved, but if that thought is involved in such a way that you are fully aware of the relative provisional nature of those objects of that thought.
Yes, precisely.
It effectively is still no thought coverings.
Yes.
Because your mind is not clouded, it's not covered by assumptions and views about those things with which you are perceiving and manipulating that kind of a way.
Yeah, well, yes, that's exactly right. It is a bodhisattva is his perceiving everything with pure, clear, naked awareness. There's no obstructions on it. There's nothing imputed on it. So he's seen everything it is. So everything that he does arises out of that pure awareness. So every action of body, speech, and mind, you could say, of a bodhisattva in that state is an action of pure awareness.
To the extent that it's still necessary to manipulate data, you can still manipulate data.
You're just
doing it with a full knowledge of the provisionality of those.
That's right. Well, he's obviously functioning in samsara, if you like, if he's helping sentient beings, and if he has compassion for them, it is that in itself is functioning in conventional reality. But it's everything is done out of this clear awareness with no, without thought coverings, is without the imputation of a self onto any object of perception. Exactly what the Buddha said to Bahaya, to see things, you know, in the seeing, just the seeing.
I wonder if we have a small experience of dwelling without thought coverings in relation to anything. And you talked about the mountain. I'm just wondering if we have mundane counterparts to that in terms of not being particularly attached to a situation, which is neither positively nor negatively attached to it. Just because I do have that experience from time to time going into situations, particularly at work, where people are getting all hit up about something and I'm just not getting hit up about it. And just, I've not got attachment to all the drama around about it. And I just wonder if we get a sense of, if that's what you're talking about now, Karen, that sense of dwelling without thought coverings is just, oh, it is, that person just said that, and that person, is that seen and only they seen and they heard when they heard? I suppose we can't get a full sense of it, but I just wonder if we get a glimpse of it.
Well, perhaps you do, but I would think if you get that glimpse of it is when the mind is still.
Mm.
I think the essential thing in this dwelling without thought covering is when the mind is still. Still.
Mm.
And you can experience it in meditation. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, you can experience for lengthy periods in meditation.
I think that's where the easiest access point is, isn't it?
Mm.
I think you can also get a sense of what it is to have attenuated thought coverings in that sense of a positive mental state where you're quite open and you're not reactive. In a way, the less reactive you are, the less caught up in craving immersion you are, the clearer it will be. I think, you know, it's the meditation state where you can take that bit further because it's just less demanding.
Mm.
And somehow also one of the challenges is how you bring that back into your ordinary life.
Mm. Ultimately, I suppose you are talking about reflection, aren't you? You're talking about vipassana, really. And it's like, the spiral path you go and depends when samadhi amounts this knowledge and vision of things as they really are. But there's a difference between the two, isn't there? There's a difference between samadhi and knowledge and vision of things as they really are. But they're quite closely. Without the samadhi, you don't get the knowledge and vision of things as they really are. It's like this is the closest you can get without the insight. But I think, you know, I mean, with Bahia, he gained the insight and there's no going back in it. You know, that was it. You got it straight. But I think with us, it's more like you get an idea of what is going on. And that's the best you can do. You get an idea of what's really going on from a clear state of samadhi. But then the leap has to be taken to the inside, isn't it?
I think the experience of dwelling without thought covenant is accessible for all of us. There's no doubt about it. That, I mean, in reflection, I have found, or the first time I experienced anything like this was in reflection, when I was reflecting, and I've been reflecting probably for years before on emptiness and whatnot, but in a very concentrated, one-pointed state of reflection, where the mind was focused on that object of thinking about emptiness, and it's discursive thought. When I talk about reflection, I mean discursively thinking about it. I'm going over in my mind and trying to analyse it and get it. But it can be a very concentrated exercise where that's all there is in your mind. There's no peripheral thought of what's for the dinner or anything like that with it at all. And there can be then just a spontaneous shift. Just inexplicable shift that's just, and the mind shifts into complete stillness with non-discursive thought, where there is no thought arising, or if a thought does arise, it's not followed and becomes a train of thought. The mind is still and calm and clear, and really all the experience of that is just in that state of awareness, not of awareness of a thing. It's just as if it's the mind being awareness of awareness. It's not, but I'm not saying that it's that you only access this in reflection. I'm sure I think once you access this, it's perhaps easier to access it again, even through doing the mindfulness of breathing. It's concentration. It's one point of focus on the object of your meditation or of your reflection. And you can get that shift. My experience of it, of reaccessing that sort of thing, has changed. In that if I'm sitting reflecting and it is focused, or if I'm meditation and it's focused, a creak in the central heating, or a slight muscle spasm, or a sharp intake of breath, and it's a shift into from something discursive or something object that I'm meditating on, whether it's the breath or anything else, and it is a shift then. And the most common thing I get is as if it was a mild electric shock literally going through my head. And I get a spontaneous shift or a precipitated shift into where my mind just suddenly goes still. And it is an experience of being just aware of no thing. If you remember when I was talking about the idea of spontaneous arising and ceasing, and saying, well, if it's spontaneous, then there's no before and no after and no forward and no back. And I said, the interesting thought, as an aside, does this mean emptiness isn't limited in time and space?
No.
Now, the experience of sitting with just your mind completely still with no thing is timeless, and it has no boundaries. And after that experience, I thought, maybe there was something in that little aside that, you know, you can have a state, even if it's just a temporary thing in your meditation, of feeling that timelessness and no boundaries to it. But it's accessible. We can all access it. I'm not saying it's insight or it's anything else. It's an experience. Hopefully that might eventually lead to insight. But it's there for us all. And I think, I'm quite sure that most of us or probably all of us, have had experience, instincts of just this sort of thing. Like the Buddha, before he was a Buddha, and the rose apple tree experience sort of thing. You know? Just a moment or two of that pure, clear awareness. And I think that's what the Bodhisattva is dwelling in this. It's his mode of being, if you like, of pure, clear awareness with nothing, no self imputed on any of the objects of perception. Any points?
What's the only thing that's coming when you talk like that? And I suppose my experience of those moments has been that there's a timelessness quality, but there's also this other quality which I've spoken of, is of becoming accustomed to that state of because what does come up is fear before that state, or there can be fear around that state for me. What came with that was a sense of just having to, is learning to make that journey, so that, just to make that journey into that space of whatever, dropping into that timeless space or that space where there's just flow, is to let go of all of the holding on. But there was an experience of fear before it, real visceral fear.
But it is even that experience of non-discursive thought, of no thought coverings, if you like, sitting in that, it can actually, if anything, go a bit deeper, because what I found is that perceptions sort of disappear. You know, it's like when we're very concentrated in doing something, sometimes our perceptions dim, if you like. Someone could say something and you didn't hear them because you were so concentrated. And it's like that. So it goes beyond just your mind being still. There's no perceptions arising either, or nothing coming in. There's no sort of input, external input, as you might say. And rightly or wrongly, I thought that is a kind of shift from meditation into contemplation, just where there is nothing. But that's speculative. But it is, even perceptions can dim or quieten down, or you become not aware of them. You're only aware of the stillness. You're only sitting in the stillness with no. But I think probably the experience of the fear before it, I think this idea of something that precipitates the shift probably would dissipate fear. Mm. It would go from just a concentration into a stillness.
I mean, it happened once when I was doing a play. Which is why it's interesting. I was doing a play, and it was, and there was a complete dropping away. There's all the stress of going out there, and the complete fear. And I'd always characterised it psychologically, this experience of this complete dropping away, and there only being this moment and the flow, and there was no differentiation between me and character. There was nothing. There was just the expression. And there was no lack of perception of what was going on, but there was no traffic around it either. Yeah. There was just the expression of this moment, and it was incredible. And it was quite attenuated. It went on quite a long time. And I remember the sadness when it ended. It was just profound sadness when I had to come back and pick up self.
But quite different to your experience of when you emerge from it. Normally I find that if I come out of a state like that, or in meditation or contemplation, whatever you call it, awareness is coming back in, my awareness is really heightened to the point that everything is quite vivid for a time. But my mind still is still quiet, And yet everything, every movement, every the carpet, whatever you see is much more vivid than normal for a while until nonsense starts going through your head again.
That's the spiritual practice, though, isn't it? That is it, from a naturally occurring event to an event that occurs within a spiritual practice. That's what practice is, isn't it? That sense of taking a naturally occurring state, but that the practice allows us to flow with that much more consistently. And I wasn't practicing at that time, so there's a sense of but nowhere to put that experience and nowhere to...
That's the training.
Training, that's the training. That's the training. That's what the cushion's about, isn't it?
All those who appear as Buddhas in the three periods of time, fully awake to the utmost right and perfect enlightenment, because they have relied on the perfection of wisdom. So, it's claimed that all Buddhas of past, present and future owe their attainment of enlightenment to the realization of the complete emptiness of the perfection of wisdom.
Could I just ask you to go back a minute, Simon? I'm sorry, you should have said this earlier. Could you just say what about the business of he has not been made to tremble? In the absence of thought coverings, he has not been made to tremble.
Yes. Well, if, as I did say, if you are dwelling without thought covering, then you're not imputing a self onto any object of perception. Okay? So there's no thing. There's no duality at all. But there is also no thing, because you haven't, no discursive thought, you're not labelling. If you're not labelling, you're not clinging. If you're not clinging, you're not grasping, and you're not creating the cause of suffering.
Okay. Yeah.
So he's got nothing to tremble about. There's nothing, there's no suffering, there's nothing to cause him suffering.
Thank you, that was useful. So he's not wobbling. In the absence of thought coverings, he's in a wobble-free situation.
That's totally it.
Excellent.
No wobbles.
So if the wobbles, if the thought coverings are like one of those executive toys you get, you know that, so here's thought covering, here's made to tremble.
Therefore, one should know the Pranaya Paramita as the mantra of great knowledge, the utmost mantra, the unequaled mantra, a layer of all suffering, in truth, for what could go wrong. By the Pranaya Paramita has this mantra been delivered. It runs like this: gone, gone, gone beyond, gone altogether beyond. Oh, what an awakening. All hail. So the mantra has some kind of magical effect that opens up the mind to transcendental wisdom, to emptiness, to enlightenment.
I have a friend who's in a Thich Nhat Hanh sangha, and he says that Thich Nhat Hanh translates this as gone, gone, gone altogether, all gone, gone starting it. We've all gone together.
All gone together.
Together. In other words, everybody's gone together. But that's an alternative translation of it.
Rather than gone altogether.
Rather than gone altogether, we've gone all everybody together.
So it's more a play of words rather than a translation.
It's a play of words. Yeah. But he said, but that's I don't know the.
Doesn't make sense to me in terms of the perfection of wisdom, really. I mean, gone, gone. How did Bhante once say it? And I'm not sure that I totally agree with it, but he said the first gone is gone beyond the conditioned. The second gone is gone beyond the unconditioned. Gone, gone, gone beyond is gone beyond the difference between the conditioned and the unconditioned. And gone altogether beyond is the emptiness of emptiness. Which is Pratitya Samutpada, the emptiness of emptiness.
I suspect that's Taina Han's emphasis on interbeing, that we're all doing it together.
Yes.
That's his particular thing, isn't it?
Teaching spin rather than translation.
Teaching spin rather than translation.
Yes. I just interpret it that the gone altogether beyond is that you have gone beyond all concepts altogether. That there's neither conditioned, unconditioned, or anything else. You've gone beyond the conditioned, the unconditioned, but the unconditioned is greed, hatred, and delusion. It's not anything other than greed, hatred, and delusion. So that's what we've gone beyond there. So, to try to put into practice a wee bit what I've been talking today, I was just thinking this morning for a reflection this afternoon, that to reflect on form is emptiness and emptiness is form. We take that and we sit with it in our meditation and we reflect that form is emptiness and emptiness is form. And remembering or letting it be in our mind that it really means there's no separation between form and emptiness. We can't have form without emptiness. We can't, if we have emptiness without form, form wouldn't be form. So we're thinking, reflecting that form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Feelings are empty, emptiness are feelings. Perceptions are empty, emptiness is perception. Impulses are empty, emptiness is impulses. Consciousness is empty, emptiness is consciousness. For this to be the five skandhas are empty, but emptiness is the five skandhas. And to reflect on that, and after a quarter of an hour or so, I'll ring the bell and you'll stop reflecting on it and sit with that form is emptiness, emptiness is form in your mind, not discursively, just letting it rest there, what you've been reflecting on. Let it rest there. And if a thought does rise, let your mind be still as possible. And if a thought arises, just let it arise and cease. Try not to follow it, just let it liberate itself. And try and sit still with that as a reflection this afternoon and absorb the whole thing that you've been reflecting on with as still a mind as possible. Now, whether you get your mind totally still or not doesn't matter, but if you really just sit with it and try, not discursively, that you have been doing in reflection, but just to try and absorb form is empty and emptiness is form, or the whole five skandhas are empty. Everything is empty, but emptiness is everything. Everything is Pratitya Samutpada.